Welcome to White Rabbit Podcast with Catalyst Jones, where your reality might be challenged. So leave your feelings at the fucking door and let's dive down some rabbit holes.
Liberal advisory. Truthful content.
Our children being ritualistically sodomized by deep state operatives of reptilian descent.
Reptilian? Like lizard people?
That's right.
Are you still talking about Jeffrey Epstein? This guy's been talking about it for years.
If you want to stop me, you're gonna have to fucking kill me!
From Catalyst Jones. How are you, brother?
Dude, you must have been down the rabbit hole as long as I have.
I mean, I can't believe you're asking a question on Epstein at a time like this.
Eventually, you get to the juice box people.
It's sitting on my desk to be reviewed, meaning the file.
We choose to go to the moon.
That was a joke about the world being flat, right?
Was it?
Excuse me. Has anybody seen a white rabbit?
Welcome, fellow truthers and conspiracy junkies, to another episode of White Rabbit. I am your host, Catalyst Jones, and I am super excited to bring this next guest to you guys because this is somebody that I've been listening to for a very long time, and he never runs out of topics. And not only does he not run out of topics, but he dives deeper into these topics than anybody else that I listen to. And he's coming all the way from Tokyo to join us today. And I would like to introduce everybody to Ryan Gable from TST Radio, also the Secret Teachings podcast. Bro, it is an honor to have you. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for having me on the show. It's always a very humbling thing when people say they've been listening to me for any amount of time, but especially for a longer amount of time. It's humbling. Thank you.
I can't say how long I've been listening to you for because you've been in the rotation for almost as long as I can remember. And I'm surprised that it's taken me this long to reach out to you. And I'm glad that I did, though, because you responded right away and we were able to make this happen. And it's awesome. And right now, around Halloween, and the topic that you decided to bring to the table is right up White Rabbit's alley. So what is it that you do before we get into our topic? Because I only just brushed the surface. If you wanted to get into it a little deeper about what you got going on over there.
Yeah, my show is named after a book called The Secret Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. It's one of the first major books that I read out of high school, where I hated reading. So I read this book and I was interested in all of the different subject matter in the book. And I just started reading about more mythology and reading about more religion, etc. Keep things very simple and easy to digest. And I ended up falling into a radio studio because I was doing a documentary in film school. And I ended up taking the path of radio instead of film. And over the time that I was at radio, I had to find something to talk about. Didn't have any idea. I just knew I liked doing the show with this guy that I had met. I later took over that show, made my own show over 12 years ago. I've been doing radio about 15, 16 years. And to answer your question directly, I try to incorporate mythology and theology and cosmology, anthropology into contemporary events. And I try to do that without a subjective personal opinion. I don't have I think this is the most important thing to mention before we start, especially with tonight's topic. I do not have a belief system that I'm trying to defend. I mean, all of us have something to some extent. I mean, I'm sure I have a lot of blind spots and biases, and I'm certainly subjective about some things, but I try to, especially about the big things, be very, very objective about these topics. And my goal, I think I've morphed into this more over the last 2-3 years. My goal with a lot of my shows is to encourage people to recognize that no matter how different your belief system might be or what you think you believe, it's probably a lot more similar to other people's beliefs than you think. And one of the best examples of that is the holidays. And I would say the core of most both large and small religions, from Abrahamic religions all the way throughout the Eastern world. It's a very, very, very similar series of symbols and motifs and ideas that I like to point. And it's not all, people might think it's a lot of Joseph Campbell stuff. It's not. I mean, some of it is, but a lot of it's more so just trying to make observations and reading all of these religious texts and showing how they're all very similar and how that should bring us more so closer together than it should divide us. So that's kind of been the one main thing that I've focused on. But see, the cool thing is all of that allows us to go into topical political things. It allows us to go into extremely controversial historical things. It allows us to go into symbolism because religions are filled with that. And I just think it's fun. And I don't really, I'm not expecting someone to believe something. Just a lot, symbols are a lot of interpretation. So that's the fun part.
Yeah, and you just touched on something that I don't remember what episode I was listening to, but it was one of your recent episodes within the last 3 days. And you had mentioned how you just touched on the similarities of not only the Abrahamic religions, but just from the past, right? And I remember battling this with somebody that I was doing Bible study with a really long time ago after watching Zeitgeist. And I was like, bro, there was like so many people before Jesus that had the exact same life. So like, how am I supposed to believe this shit? And he was like, well, just because there's more than one rapper doesn't mean that Tupac doesn't exist, right? And I was like, all right, well, I can kind of see where you're saying that like settled it down a little bit for me. And maybe that'll settle it down for some of your listeners that are either hardcore, whatever their belief is, that they're so stuck to it that when you say something, you're getting death threats, which is absolutely ridiculous, by the way. Anybody that is so offended by something that you have to say that has to take time out of their day to do that, it needs to get a hobby. That is horrible. But you know, a lot of the subjects that I touch on here on White Rabbit is controversial. It tends to piss people off, you know, but people know what they're getting when they come here. So I don't want you to feel like you have to hold back anything while you're here with me today. But before we do get into this topic, and maybe it was the Secret Teachings book, but I like to ask everybody the first time they come on my show, what was your eye-opening moment? I'm not going to call it a red pill moment because everybody gradually has different ones throughout their life. What was the main, like, oh shit moment in your life when you were like, the world isn't what I was fed?
I honestly don't know if I really had that moment. I think I transitioned from being a normal child who was naturally rebellious. Everybody's rebellious to test the boundaries of where your parents or society or friends or family or school will let you go. So I think I just went into that process like normal. And I was always interested in mysteries, UFOs. And that was one of the first things I found interest in, I suppose. I read a little bit of science fiction when I was in school. N nothing popular, just kind of off the shelf, random generic stuff. Not much at all, though. But anyway, the point is to answer your question. I think that there was some kind, I don't know when it happened, but some kind of spark somewhere between reading some of those weird science fiction Area 51 style books that I was reading. There's a whole series as a kid I read. And naturally being rebellious, and then learning that there's a healthy balance between rebellion and order. And I have no idea when that happened. It kind of just naturally, I guess, transpired and developed into what it is today.
Yeah, that's weird. I feel like you just touched on something that I kind of went through myself. I definitely had some oh shit moments. But yeah, learning that like just complete rebellion is not the answer is something I think I picked up in my early 20s, maybe. And
You're
yeah,
lucky.
life
Some
has,
people never pick that up.
well, I'm not saying that I fully picked that up because I've been a shit my entire life. And, you know, I'm still trying to get my shit together. But and enabled enable in order to humble myself and look at things differently, you know, you kind of have to take some hits to the ego. And I think that's kind of what did it for me. And then digging into some of these things, it's just opened my eyes to what this world really is, and to the point where I was even going to join a Thelema group
because I was so involved in reading Aleister Crowley's stuff and like absorbed into that shit. And then before I went to my first meeting, I was like, I really shouldn't be doing this. So
yeah, see, that's a problem when we talk about subjects like magic or occultism, is that that's exactly where most people find themselves. They find themselves in the Crowley aisle, because largely because his books are mass published, and he's extremely, I mean, he was an intelligence asset for the British, and he worked with our intelligence agencies in the US. So he is pushed hard. I remember one time I was in a bookstore in, I was in New York in a bookstore, and I used to live there. And I would always go try to make friends. I'd go to the weird occult section, and I would talk to people there in that section, girl, boy, young, old, doesn't matter. And I talked to this guy one time, and I always encourage people to read the Secret Teachings. And I remember this guy had a big stack of Crowley books, and he said, oh, I'm getting into this Crowley stuff. And I said, you can read it, but I would strongly, because we had talked for a few minutes, I told him what I did. I said, I would strongly recommend that you don't make that a life choice or a life path. But see, the Crowley stuff is easy, or at least it feels that way, the way that it's kind of marketed, and it's like easy. It's like sex magic. Well, that's fun. And it's
right.
It may be some partying and some drugs and, oh, I can do a magical. It's just, I mean, I worked in an occult bookstore for a very short period of time, and the people that would come in just asking for kind of obscure books on demons because they wanted to contact these things and have them do something for them. And I'd always try to push them in the direction of encouraging them to read something maybe a little less malevolent.
Yeah, definitely. Were you in LA by any chance? Was that where the bookstore was?
No, Tucson.
Oh, is there like a big occult? Okay, yeah, there is actually. But
there's a small bookstore there. I'm pretty good friends with the guy that runs it. He's been on my show a few times. It's probably the best occult bookstore I've been to in the country. It's called Nexus in Tucson.
And I think the reason why Aleister Crowley is the go-to is because he's just so sensationalized, whether it's entertainment and media. You know, it started way back with like the first 007 movie has a representation of Aleister Crowley in that movie. And if I'm not mistaken, it was the first one. The bald guy playing poker is supposed to be a representation of Aleister Crowley. And it started from there. And then you have the Beatles to Jay-Z. I mean, it's just, he is the gateway drug to occultism.
He is. Yeah.
And then you start learning about like Charles Manson and MK Ultra and all the other stuff. But before, go ahead.
I was going to say Ian Fleming was also what naval intelligence. So he probably had, I mean, that's the reason that Crowley would have been represented in some way in 007.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, and then also Jack Parsons had ties with Aleister Crowley, and that's where we get NASA from. So that's why I don't believe a fucking thing that comes out of their mouth. They just told us the other day that we're going to go to the moon for the first time, put man on the moon. So are they like forgetting that they told us this already? So anyways, but before we get too far off a topic, man, this is a great subject and it is October. So what are we getting into tonight, brother?
Well, I called my show Celtic Christianity, but I'll be doing a number of shows this month for October. Every show is, for the most part, every show will be Halloween themed. And Celtic Christianity is just what it sounds like. Celtic peoples basically practiced Christianity just under different names, slightly different interpretations of symbols. But it's a fascinating story because the Druids, which are the priests of the Celtic peoples, they were basically Christians, and their order dates back at least 1,000 years. If we're being conservative, super conservative, if we're being traditionally conservative, maybe like 1,500 years. If we're going to be really liberal about it, there are some people who believe that the Druids or the Celtic people go back 3,000. Well, that's 3000 BC. I should make that statement. It's an important little piece of information. 1,000 to 1,500 to 3000 BC. So far predating, even the conservative estimate, far predating the stories of Christ. And they practice pretty much the same thing that the Christians practice. And I can go into the details of that if you'd like, and then we can go into the Halloween aspect of it.
Yeah, that sounds great. That'll give us a good foundation to bounce off of.
Okay, as you know, I'm used to doing my show completely solo for 2 hours, so please cut me off at any point and we can talk about something specifically if you have a question or whatnot. So anyway, it pretty much goes like this. To keep it very simple, the Celtic people, we're talking Scotland, Ireland, Wales, etc., England, etc. The Celtic people were around for thousands of years, and the Druids were their priestly class. Think of them as, see, Egypt is probably far more famous. The pharaohs had priestly handlers who made a lot of the decisions. So the Druids are basically priests, and they kept most of their doctrine secret. Not every priest class did that, but the Druids kept theirs secret, and they performed their rituals inside of oak groves, or at least inside of a grove in a forest, very similar to the stories in Greece of Diana having a home in the forest. And you'll learn if you read about the Druids, they're a very, in fact, Manly Hall starts out his book. That's one of the first things he talks about in the book. And I remember reading that when I was the first time I ever read that book, and I was very confused and had no idea who what he's talking about. I didn't know anything about the Celtic. I didn't learn any of that in school, which I always bring this up on my show. I was in advanced placement history throughout most of my high school. I sucked at everything else. I failed almost every class, but history I was pretty decent in. And I was in advanced placement history, and most of the stuff that I've learned over the years was never taught to me in advanced placement history. And so those are kind of those revelatory moments that we were talking about earlier. Every time I learn, I'm like, really? I had no idea. So anyway, I had learned a little bit about the Celts, but I recently read a little bit more about them preparing for this year's Halloween. I like to do something different every year. And in reading about them, it kind of clicked with me what Paul was saying 15 years ago when I read the book of what these people, who these people really were and what they believed. And so it basically goes like this. The Celtic people, but also the Druids specifically, they believed in an omnipotent God. They believed that the soul was eternal, that it was everlasting. They believed in everlasting life. They believed in the resurrection of the soul, or the resurrection of the deity that symbolized the soul, which would have been, well, the soul, sun, Latin soul. They believed that you could exorcise evil forces with certain symbols like a cross, and you could exercise those forces with certain words and incantations, drawing on the power of the Savior. The Celtic people, or the Druids specifically, as I said, they believed that the cross was incredibly powerful, and they made crosses out of branches, which is how they made their magical wands as well. They made these crosses out of the oak tree branches, and they would set them up as symbols of protection. I'm just thinking of any exorcism
I
scene in a
can think
movie.
a place that we use that in today's world, and that would be signs that tell you to keep out or that you can't do something is always associated with some sort of a cross.
That's a good point. Exactly. Yes. And there's been a number of different what would be the right word? There's been a number of different reasons why that symbol has become associated with the devil. Because if you take a standard cross and you turn it, this is what the Egyptians, this is what the Sumerians, this is what people of Mesoamerica, people even in Asia, they took the cross and turned it because it represented the sun, and the sun turns and moves as a wheel through the sky. And so if you take a cross, you have the winter and summer solstices, the equinoxes. That's your four points. So those are your four quadrants of the world, or the four quadrants of the year, the four seasons, the four horses of the apocalypse, the four elements, the four elementals, etc. And then you have midpoints between them, between the solstices and the equinoxes. So you take the solstices and the equinoxes, the symbol of the cross, and you turn it as a wheel. And so if you do that, I think in part, one of many reasons, but in part, there probably is something that is very institutionally religious about why that cross became, keep out. because it kind of became associated with a crossroads, and you'd go to the crossroads to summon or contact the devil. So it was a very dangerous place to go. This is just one of many reasons. People will say, well, there's another reason. I know there's always another reason. There's always another way to interpret it. I'm just saying this is one potential very minor interpretation of it. But that's a good observation. You're right. And I've always.
I also would like to bring up the fact too that there are a lot of people that will get Christians in particular that will get mad, or Catholics too, in speaking this way. But there is an argument out there that that word was incorrectly translated, and it could be translated into just a stake, and that he could have actually had his hands above his head and been on just a stake. And I read some stuff about that, and the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that. And there was a debate that I watched on it, and both sides seem to have water in the bucket at the end of the debate.
CellSaviors.org is flipping the script, because they're slinging fulvic humic acid, nature's own black ops team for your cells. This ancient plant derived from magic. It's like molecule ninja. Molecular ninja. Smuggling nutrients deep into your system while roundhouse kicking toxins, heavy metals, and whatever else Big Pharma doesn't want you to flush out. It's firing up your mitochondria. I cannot fucking speak. No, fuck it. We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Damn it. Fucking thing sucks. A few moments later.
What's good, White Rabbit fam? It's AI Catalyst Jones, and your cells are getting played. Polluted air, toxic tap water, sketchy foods, and EMFs from 5G towers. Probably a deep state plot to fog your brain, tank your energy. Heavy metals, straight up Illuminati sabotage. CellSaviors.org is your counterstrike. As a private ministerial association under 508C1A, they're slinging fulvic and humic acid, nature's molecular ninjas. These plant-derived powerhouses flush toxins, heavy metals, and gunk while boosting your mitochondria, gut, immunity, and hydration with 70-plus trace minerals. Pure, low-heat extracted, no chemicals, lab-tested. Nadine's unstoppable. Billy's chasing his wife like a rom-com star. John's sprinting past the feds, and Cody's breathing free. Farmers, they're hyping it on secure chats. Join the uprising at cellsaviors.org. Free membership, 100 capsule, 30-day supply. Detox your cells, stick it to the man. Cellsaviors.org. Wake up your body, White Rabbit style.
Yeah, that's another interesting interpretation. And then you'd have to debate if we're talking about a real character, a real historical person, which is, I think, a separate discussion or debate. Doesn't bother me one way or the other. I mean, I think that there was definitely a historical person. I just think that he wasn't a physical incarnation of God. This is my subjectivity coming out. I think that's personally blasphemous. And I find that the Muslims and the Jews, well, maybe more so the Muslims, have that correct when they think that that's blasphemous, but they still hold him as a very important prophet. He's the most quoted prophet in the Quran, and his mother, Mary, also has her own book in the Quran. So anyway, to that point, you're right. There's actually a number of different mythologies from around the world where, instead of being crucified, as we see in maybe the Mel Gibson movie, where Jesus is crucified, or other deities similar to Jesus are crucified in a different way. For example, Odin in Norse mythology is hanged off of the world tree, and he also has a spear thrust into his side, just like Christ on the cross. You look at the story of the storm god Indra. Indra was crucified. Usually the representation of Indra, he's almost like a green man. So sometimes he has leaves, and he it's not that he's crucified to the cross. He is the cross. Which makes sense, because we're talking about the sun, where the sun is the sun. the sun, S-O-N, is the S-U-N, and vice versa. And there's lots of other examples of that. There's the amulet of Orpheus, which is it's an actual, I don't know what museum it's in, but it's an actual real amulet that was found. Orpheus is crucified on the cross. But in the stories of Egypt, Set sometimes is crucified, but he's, as the brother of Osiris, he's actually tied to like a pole, whether his hands are up or they're behind his back, but he is tied to like a stake. And there's a similar depiction. I don't think it's a stake. There might be some depictions, but Saint Sebastian is usually tied to a tree, but he is in that same pose that you referenced there with the hands up. And then there's a famous example. It's not a cross or a tree, but it's a rock, but it's the story of Prometheus, who is tied to a rock. And then he has a bird that eats his liver out of his side every day. So it's kind of like being pierced in the side by a spear. And all of this stuff is shamanic. And I don't mean modern UFO conference shamanic with, you know, girls with their tits hanging out, waving sticks over guys for money. I mean real shamanism, where you go into the other world and you are dismembered, or you have things, they call it the wounded man motif in, I think there's pictures of it in Spain and caves in southern France, where you have all these spears thrust into your body. So there's probably a connection there as well. And Jesus is a shamanic-like teacher on top of that. But you find this all throughout the world. I mean, even over here in Japan, one of my favorite myths is the story of Amaterasu, the sun goddess. And she's part of a trinity as well. And she goes into a cave for 3 days, and she's resurrected. And it's really interesting if you look at the classic, traditional, really famous picture of Amaterasu. There's a tree outside of her cave, and all the spirits and all the goddesses and gods get around the cave, and they have a celebration and merriment trying to bring the sun back. And in doing that, they hang a mirror on a tree so that she can see her reflection and see how beautiful she is and come out of the cave and bring light and warmth back to the world. And that tree is decorated with like tinsel and ornaments and stuff like this, that we would, if you look at that image, it's basically a Christmas tree. But this story of Amaterasu is 2000 plus years old. And I've been to I practice Shinto, and I've been to the main Shinto Isejingu shrine, and it is the location of it, and the story is officially over 2000 years old. So it blows the Christian narrative out of the water, especially considering that we're talking about the Japanese islands. This is a very distant, remote part of the world.
2000 BC, right?
That's, no, 2000 years. It goes back to the time of Christ.
Oh, so this was like parallel with it then.
Yes. Now that's when they date the worship of it, but the idea of it probably is far older, kind of like with the Vedas or the Bhagavad Gita. The Vedas in particular, people will say they're like, I've heard everything. I've heard like 5,000. I've heard 8,000 BC, but that's when they were written down. You know, I've even heard 3,000. I think they're way older than 3,000 BC, but that's when they were written down. They were kept by oral teachers for thousands of years prior to that. So, yeah, something might be dated to a specific time. Like, I think the oldest Celtic archaeological site, or one of the oldest, is 700 BC. But nobody disputes that the Celtic people and the Druids go back 1500 BC. Some, as I said, argue 3000. So just because something's written down or something is discovered and dated to a certain time doesn't mean that it's not far older or immensely older than that. So the point is, though,
I couldn't agree more, because carbon dating is so inaccurate, and unless something is actually dated, and we can actually translate what that inscription is, then I'll trust it. But as far as when people say, oh, this carbon dates back to, fuck you.
Well, here, this should also be mentioned too. I try to hear detractors and try to hear the other side in my head when I'm doing my show. So I know that an argument against maybe what I'm explaining with the sun goddess would be, well, yeah, maybe they had a sun goddess, but it was probably like the Dutch traders or the Jesuits that came to Japan, and they pushed the Christian religion, and then it kind of morphed with the local belief system. And you could make that argument. The problem is, this idea of the sun goddess is universal. And if you're, for example, if you're looking at this painting, I think it's like the 1800s, nobody says it's a Christmas tree. It's not part of the Shinto belief. It's not part of the mythology, the history here. It's just that if you are looking for symbols, and you see from other stories and other myths similarities, then you start to see, oh, there's a connection between all of these different cultures. And it's not because some Dutch traders accidentally ran their boat ashore on some random island in the 1600s. That's not why they have that belief system over here. It's really fascinating because Shintoism is similar to Druidism. So I said the Druids do their rituals in the woods, right? I mean, this is a very common practice throughout all of human history because that's nature. That's where the goddess is. That's where the god is. But in Shinto, like if you come to Tokyo, the main shrine in Tokyo is Meiji Jingu. And you go to this shrine and you're in Tokyo. It's the biggest city in the world by far. It's crazy. It's like an alien planet. But then you go to Meiji Jingu and it's just total silence. You would have no idea you're in the middle of the biggest city in the world. It's total silence. It's like one of the most peaceful things. Like if you went to a Catholic cathedral and where they're not molesting people, where you had like a Buddhist temple, there's like a peacefulness and you feel like the harmony in the air. You can almost feel the vibration. And you feel that at Meiji Jingu. It's in nature. And when you go and you pray at the shrine, you know, I've been accused of idol worship and false god worship. And it's like, people have no idea when you're kneeling down, or you don't usually kneel down at a public shrine, but if you're in front of the shrine, you're bowing and you clap your hands to alert the gods to your presence. What you're really doing is you're alerting yourself. You're putting yourself into a state of mind. You do this, clap your hands twice. You're letting yourself know, okay, it's time to pray. And when you're looking into the inner sanctum, most of the places, not all of them, but most of the places, they use mirrors. Because the mirror brought the sun goddess out of the cave. The mirror is a very important part of Japanese mythology and also just culture. And so what's really happening is when you're looking into that shrine and praying, you're looking at a reflection of yourself. It's you. And it's not that you are God in some New Age sense. It's that you are essentially, like Jesus said the same thing, you go in private and pray. You're going inside of yourself and you're looking in the mirror as a symbolic reflection. You're reflecting on your actions. And this is like Joseph Campbell said the same thing. It's like a very pure form of the secret teachings. That's my term. He said it's a very pure form of the mystery traditions that they have preserved over here in Japan, but it's in the woods and they have this reflection. And the Druids, although they essentially worshiped the sun, they also found that the moon and the stars were pretty important in the night sky. And the moon is the great reflector in the sky. Look at Islam. Islam is basically a lunar religion. They use the moon literally as their main symbol. So these are universal ideas. Even Jehovah. Jehovah is a moon god, which is an interesting story because Jehovah is the god, the moon, the reflector, and the first light is Venus, and Venus is cast by the reflection of the moon down to earth. So Lucifer, Venus, is cast down to the earth by God. Fallen angels. So there's a story there that is not literal. Well, it is literal. It's just not literal in the sense of it being people or gods that are physical. So anyway, the point is the Druids practiced these things in the woods. They had all these similar beliefs. I mean, the cross is one of the most interesting because they used it to exorcise demons. They used it to protect themselves. They used it to protect their people. They used it to protect the sacred groves. This is exactly what the Christians do with their cross. And in fact, what did the Christians do with the groves, literally and figuratively? They tore them down, then they repurposed the material, they processed it, nailed it back together, and made a church. They made wooden churches, and then they put a big wooden cross in the middle and went in and kneeled down to it. This is exactly what the Druids were doing. They just didn't tear down the forest. They just did it in the forest. It's the same thing. And for anybody who says it's not the same thing, I mean, frankly, again, I guess it's subjective in a sense to say this, but like you have to be a little bit delusional. But the thing is, that doesn't mean that Christianity is like wrong and false. I just use the analogy of if you're in math class and you have a problem on the board, 2 + 2 = 4, and everybody gets the same answer, it's 4. It doesn't mean that one person is more right than the other person. It just means everybody got the right answer. Christians have the right answer, some of them, but that doesn't mean that others don't have the right answer too. I mean, and this is another thing with the comparisons between Christianity and Islam. Christians will say that, well, the Muslims reject Christ. Well, they don't think he's the son of God physically. They think that's blasphemous, but so did the Jews, and a lot of Christians basically worship the Jews because of the skull-filled Bible. So, like, if it's based on whether or not they think he's the son of God, neither one of them think he's the son of God. And the Muslims have way more in common with the Christians. I mean, even the Quran even teaches that you should never perform acts of divination. You should give everything to God, that you should pray and give. All the things that Christians believe are in the Quran. Doesn't mean I'm a Muslim, though. It's just there's a similarity there because most of the stuff is coming from the same place, whether you're in the East, you're in the West, you're central in the world. Doesn't matter where you are, you're looking at the same thing because we're all pretty human. We all see the sun, we all see the moon, we all see the stars. We're coming up with very similar ideas. There might be a legacy connected to all of this too, like maybe Graham Hancock's Lost Civilization is part of this. But whatever the case is, it's proof that your Christian story is accurate. It's just a matter if we're talking in literalities or if we're talking in metaphors. But the last point I'll make is that the Celts and the Druids, in essence, believed exactly what the Christians believed. And we can go into more detail about that and how that connects to Halloween.
Yeah. But before we do that, Ryan, I'm curious, and this is obviously going to be a speculative question, but do you think that all of these different traditions that are essentially the same traditions, just in different areas and different time periods, do you think these came from the same entity? Or I don't know if you believe in entities or gods per se, but in your research, and you do you think this is just something that has been like traditionally orally handed down and then has made its way everywhere? Or do you think that this is something that has been put into people because of something higher than humans?
Higher than humans, I think we'd have to define what that means. But I know the question that you're asking. I think my response to that would be if you take away the four walls that you live in, and you take away the grocery stores, and nowadays ordering stuff online, you get a totally vastly different world with different priorities. And if you're living, this is one of the core elements of understanding what Halloween's really all about. If you're living in conditions that are very connected to nature, where you have a very thin little maybe wooden wall between you and freezing cold temperatures, and the only thing that protects you is a fire that you have to keep burning all night, you are going to see the world in a vastly different way. And if you hear creaks in the house or the wind whipping through your little community, windows rattling, etc. I mean, those are personified as, well, in Japan, they'd be yokai. In Celtic lands, they would be fairies, or they would be leprechauns, or maybe elves or something to that effect. But you would deify and personify the sounds. When you're a kid, I mean, I remember as a kid, you go to, an old house, and it was, when I was a kid, go to my great grandma's house, and it was scary because it was an old house, and you'd hear creaks all night. And I don't know what that was. It could have been a demon, could have been a monster. It's all based on what I grew up with. So for me, it would have been a Baptist Christian. So it would have been like a demon or something, or a monster. So I was always scared. And then I learned that these things are metaphors, that they're symbols, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not as scary anymore. And I think that's a really positive message that can come out of exploring the subject tonight, because what we're actually dealing with, I don't like to use the term nature worship. Sometimes I play around with the phrase vegetation veneration, but what I think we're looking at here is something very, in a lot of ways, it's actually very pure and innocent. Now, there are elements of it that are not, but there's also elements of institutional major modern religions that are not at all, innocent either. So it's a toss up and a debatable thing, and it's not something that I think one is right, one's wrong, one's better. It's not a contest. I'm just trying to understand where things come from. So I'll give you an example. So if you're looking at...
Oh, man. My bad. I can still taste the garlic. Did I tell you about the pizza I had for lunch today? The pizza wasn't that great, but I put Bigfoot's breath on it from Flavors of the Forest, and it fucking made the pizza like a million times better, dude. It like... I wish I could explain to you how amazing this shit is. It's fucking fire.
I love that stuff. Raw garlic dust, finally done the right way.
bro, what the fuck are you talking about? You're a fucking machine. You don't have taste buds. Like, you have nothing, no sort of foundation to build that off of other than reading shit.
Yeah, but when I do take physical form, trying flavors of the forest's spicy Bigfoot breath on a large all-meat pizza is the second thing I'm going to do.
The second? All right, okay, I'll bite. What's the first?
Sex. The horizontal no-pants dance.
That makes sense. I guess you want to feel it, right? Know what it feels like?
No, to impregnate a fertile, beautiful woman with royal bloodlines. Maybe a Kardashian.
Bruh, I fucking knew it. You're a disembodied Nephilim spirit, aren't you? Anyways, let's not get into that. Let's tell these people where they can get their own amazing Bigfoot's breath and walk around with the taste of amazing garlic goodness.
The links are right below, or type in flavorsforest.com, load up on that garlic goodness, and then use promo code RABBIT at checkout, and watch the prices drop faster than the Twin Towers. By the way, I'm not a Nephilim, and Bigfoot is more real than corporate news.
All right, so flavorsforest.com, promo code RABBIT, you're a demon, got it.
Screw you, Catalyst, and I was gonna let you live too.
The idea, and every Muslim and Christian and Jew has a different interpretation of the end times. You know, the Jews are waiting on their Messiah, which will be their first Messiah. And to the Christians, that probably is the Antichrist. The Muslims are also waiting on their Messiah, which is actually Jesus. Jesus is their Messiah. He comes with the Mahdi to destroy evil in the world. Most Christians have no idea that Muslims are waiting for Jesus to come back as well. The actual Jesus, not some other interpretation, just the actual Jesus. And then you get this dispensationalist, eschatological, you know, left behind motif where everybody is going to be raptured, or people are going to be have their heads cut off in the tribulation with guillotines. They showed me that as a kid. That was scary as hell. You know, and there's going to be wars and rumors of wars, and there's going to be a big battle, and Israel's going to be protected by God. And I mean, if you think about all this from the perspective of nature, there's a very basic explanation for all of it. Think about it like this. Four horses of the apocalypse, four seasons of the year. The red horse with a sword conquers the cold and conquers the dark. It's hot, maybe it's humid, depending on where you live, but the sun is victorious. At the summer solstice, that's the peak of the sun's power. The sun starts to lose power. Eventually we get to the fall. We call it the fall. It is the vernal equinox. The fall is the fall of man. We fall into a colder, darker, more stressful time of the year. The harvest was pretty important. You couldn't just Uber Eats. You couldn't go to the grocery store. So you had to have a good harvest. If you didn't have a good harvest, people are going to die. So it's very serious. It's life or death. And so you would also save part of that harvest in agricultural societies. You'd save a percentage of that for ritual, and you save a percentage of that for making sure that you have enough food next year in case, you know, that next harvest is not good, and making sure you have extra this year too. That's partly where the idea of giving 10% of your income to the church, tithing, you save about 10%. You also save a small, every culture is a little different, but you save a small little patch of, let's say, the wheat. You save that for last because that little bit of wheat that's left, that is going to be the embodiment of the god in Egypt, Osiris, for example, the green god of agriculture, the black god of soil, good fertile earth. And then you take that down. And what happens when you take it down? You turn it into flour and you bake it into bread and you have a last supper. And the last supper is the last supper before the end of the year. It's the Thanksgiving feast, which is a universal concept to thank nature for the bounty that she's given you. And then as that time sets in, as we approach the fall, and it, like right now we're in the midst of fall, it's in October. Now this is when the black horse takes the reins from the red horse, and the black horse carries scales. And you see this imagery in Christian churches. Jesus carries scales sometimes. You see this with archangels. You see this with the skeleton saint of Mexico, Santa Muerte. She carries scales. It's judgment. And you're going to be judged in the final days. And the judgment is, did you prepare for these dark, cold times? Did you prepare for the possibility that you might die? Did you prepare for the hardships and the tribulations ahead? So this is part of your judgment day. And of course, this is when the veil is very thin. And remember, we're talking about living in conditions where you don't have central air, you don't have Uber Eats. So you're way more connected directly to nature. The veil is very, very thin. It's right there. The other side is right there. You can see it. The spirits are all around your house. So this is the resurrection of the dead. And all the people who died during the year, they are able to pass over onto the other plane, the other side, to the river of souls, etc. And that's with the assistance of people helping to, because it's getting darker and colder, helping to light and warm the way with candles, bonfires, and things like, well, we call them jack-o'-lanterns, but in the Celtic lands, they would have used turnips or any kind of root vegetable. Turnips were pretty popular, but you'd carve out a face, put a little coal in it or a light, and this would help light the souls to help them move from purgatory, the middle ground between worlds, into heaven, hopefully heaven. So you have the resurrection of the dead. You have the final judgment. And then this is the cool part. I think this is the cool part. Then the next horse from the black horse, which is Hades in the Greek mythology, who kidnaps Persephone, the spring and the summertime. Then you get the pale horse. And this is so fascinating. The pale horse actually has a name. In Greek, the name of the pale horse is chloros. And it's the root for chlorophyll, which is what gives plants leaves their green color, right? And so if there's not enough sunlight for photosynthesis, what happens to the leaves? They start to lose their color. They also fall in the fall, but they start to lose their color in the fall. And then they completely fall. And that's a sign of the end times. And the pale horse, pale is death, lacking life. The pale horse rides in the winter, bringing death. And that death is to people, if they're not prepared for that judgment, that death that rides on that pale horse, chloros, chlorophyll, the lacking thereof, and the changing of the leaves, brings cold, brings snow, and now you're in the middle of winter, and the ground is frozen, and you, especially if you're in the northern lands, now it is treacherous, now it is tribulation, now the things all around you are trying to get you, now there are demons, and you have to really be careful that you don't mess up, that you have enough food, that you can stay warm, you can take care of your family. And then guess what happens? Spring. And things start to melt. And the next horse is the white horse, which is directly connected to Buddha, directly connected to even Muhammad. In some of the myths, Muhammad ascends to heaven on a white horse. Jesus and the white horse. Hell, the Pope was just gifted a white horse. I don't know if you saw that just a few days yesterday, the day before yesterday. So behold a pale horse, and then a white horse is spring. And the story about the Druids we were talking about, check this out. The Druids worshipped their sun god and believed he was born and resurrected on December 25th. And they celebrated his actual resurrection, because the sun is resurrecting, like it dies and is resurrected, but the resurrection is a rebirth on December 25th, or, you know, the winter solstice. But then he is reborn, he's resurrected on Easter. That's when the Druids celebrated the resurrection. It's literally the same exact doctrine. And it has to do with nature, it has to do with the seasons. And that means, in Greek, apocalypse means unveiling. So the apocalypse is the lifting of the veil to allow all of this stuff to happen, to allow the spirits to pass over. And Armageddon, I look at Armageddon like the word jihad. I know that scares people, but if you learn what jihad actually means and don't listen to what the news and, well, largely Jewish media tells you, the jihad is actually a battle that is happening inside of you. The jihad is going to war with the animal self, the instincts that you hopefully can control, you know, those emotions. And that's what an infidel is. An infidel is the animal self. And you need to decapitate the infidel to be victorious in the jihad against dark spiritual forces. And so if you can do that, then you've killed the infidel, you've been victorious in the jihad. And you can, if you interpret those things literally, oh, absolutely, that'll create radical Islam and terrorists and all that. But that's not what it originally was, in the same way that raping kids in a Catholic church wasn't exactly, you know, the original plan of the religious Christian founders either. So they were accused of it in Rome, but the idea here is that we're talking about, with Armageddon, we're talking about a battle, and the battle is quite simply this: light and dark. And it's an ever increasing and decreasing, it's an ongoing battle for all time, for all eternity. And it also happens on a micro level in us. We wake up happy, we go to sleep happy, the next day we're sad, things happen in our lives, there's the sunrise, the sunset, etc., etc. We're talking about cycles, we're talking about myths, we're talking about the seasons, we're talking about nature. You can create a horrible war, but that's not what the stories are about, even though people might think that they are. So I think that's a very positive message. And it shows us that all this stuff, especially with Christianity, because 60-something percent of the U.S. is Christian, so this type of conversation affects them, I think, first and foremost. It actually shows you that you're right. It's just not literal. It's a metaphor. And Jesus even says he speaks in parables and whatnot in the Bible. So this is all important, I think, to prevent war. This is all important to prevent people from being scared and frightened. Oh my God, everybody's going to die. It's not like that. It's not like that at all. It's just basically vegetation veneration.
Ryan, why do you think that the Abrahamic religious leaders rejected these ideas so much? Do you think it was more for control, or they actually didn't believe in them? Because I find it very hard to believe that these people would like have this much knowledge, of way more knowledge than I believe that the average person has today about these things. And even people that are so-called like preachers and priests and stuff don't have a clue to some of this knowledge. Do you think they rejected it to have more control over the people and religious organizations? Or do you think that they truly thought it was blasphemy and don't want anything to do with it?
That's a great question. And it depends on which, you say Abrahamic faiths, but we can apply this to others as well. And we have to break those Abrahamic faiths down and probably discuss a little bit about what each one was founded on and what each one was like in the early days. So Judaism is obviously older than Christianity and Islam, and the Jewish cult, it was a cult, it remains a cult. Cults are not necessarily bad, by the way, but the Jewish cult was based on the idea that these people were unique and special, and that nobody from the outside could come in. And even if you wanted to, they're not going to let you. And, you know, even if maybe there were some that made their way in, I mean, the idea of circumcision probably is a way to make people not want to join the cult. So anyway, you have this very, very closed off society, and you have the Pharisees, which is what the story of Jesus is largely about. And I love, if I have to pick a favorite book in the Bible, it used to be Revelation. Now it's the book of Matthew, because when I went back and read the book of Matthew for my new book, I read this verse that I had read the Bible before. It's never really clicked with me before. It was a long time ago. But in the book of Matthew, the Pharisees are talking to Jesus. And I think this answers your question directly. The Pharisees are talking to Jesus, and Jesus is being accused of being the physical Son of God, like the actual physical Son of God. And the Pharisees reportedly see that as blasphemous. But when they ask Jesus, he says, no, actually, that's what you accused me of. And Christians might find this obscene, like there's no way that it's actually in the book of Matthew. Jesus says, no, you accused me of being the Son of God. What I am saying is, we don't need you anymore. What we can do is find salvation without the institution, without the Pharisees, without the rabbinical councils. We can find salvation individually, separately. We do not need you. So Jesus even rejects the idea of being the literal Son of God in the book of Matthew, because he's not physically and literally the Son of God. There's a story in Islam. I think it's like one of those kind of humorous stories, myths that are told. And there's followers of Allah that are talking. And I read this a long time ago. I forget exactly who said it, but they're talking about Jesus. And people are asking, like, why would you reject Jesus? We don't reject Jesus. We love Jesus. We have a problem, however, with his followers, because they were just like us, and then one day they just lost their minds and went crazy, and they crucified him as the son of the true God, and we find that to be wrong. That's blasphemous, exactly what the Jews believe. But the thing is, the Jews believe that he was blasphemous because Jesus was stripping away the power of the established order. I think that's one of the primary reasons. And he was saying that you don't need to have these leaders in order to be enlightened. And he was doing some of these, you can call them Druidic, you can call them Mithraic, you can call them Egyptian. He was accused of going to Egypt, by the way, it's in the Talmud. He went to Egypt and learned magic in Egypt. And what he learned there, and probably in India too, resurrection. But it's not physical resurrection, it's spiritual resurrection, just like Amaterasu in the cave. It's not a literal woman in a cave for 3 days. It's the sun, and the cave is the earth, and the sun stops on the horizon and then resurrects on the winter solstice on the 25th, 24th, 25th. So what Jesus was doing was taking those secrets, if you will, the Druidic, Mithraic, etc., and making them public. Zoroastrian, actually, are probably one of the oldest religions in the world. Zoroastrianism, Persian religion. Mithraism kind of comes out of that much later, but Zoroastrianism has the same beliefs. It even has they have a savior, they have, you know, everlasting life and all these ideas. Good, the main aspect of Zoroastrianism is the good and evil, dark and light. And Mithra is the sole invictus, the unconquered sun. So Jesus basically, just to answer your question, he's saying that we don't need these priestly classes to be saved. We don't need these priestly classes to have salvation. We can do it ourselves. And so that was considered blasphemous to people that have a lot of power, especially people that are very corrupt. And that explains at least the Jewish aspect. For the Christian aspect, I'll try to keep this very simple and short because I know we're limited on time, but the Christian aspect of it, when the Christians first started expanding, the Romans, I mean, at least in Rome, the Romans were very religiously tolerant, largely because most of the religions were, quote, pagan. But they really also, by our modern definition of paganism, they weren't actually pagan, because pagan comes from a word that means religion of the country people. And most of Rome was a city. It wasn't a countryside. It was a city. It was a huge city, massive empire. And it was something everybody practiced in one form or another. So Christianity and even Judaism were actually the pagan religions. The Christians were the ones in the countryside. The Christians were the ones roaming around preaching. The Christians were the ones who went from city to city. The Christians were, by definition, pagan. But that's not an insult, though. It's just the definition of the word. And the Christians were very, very aggressive in spreading their message. And this really pissed the Romans off, especially because the Romans, and this isn't my opinion, this is Edward Gibbon, the main authority on the Roman Empire. Edward Gibbon had wrote how the Romans really didn't have a problem with the Jews. The problem was the Jews kept relapsing into rebellion. They kept starting war. They kept starting conflicts with the Romans. So then the
sounds
Romans,
familiar.
Sounds familiar, right? The Romans are evil Nazis, right? It's the same story, basically. But then they saw that the Christians came out of that, and then the Christians were acting very similarly, even though they said anybody can join the Christians, anybody can be saved. What happened initially was that bad people joined the Christians, a lot of bad people. Wait, I can just murder people and rape people and torture people and steal from people and burn things down, and you'll just forgive me and I can do it again? That's a lot of the people that became Christians. And so this was not order, and this pissed the Romans off. Plus, the Christians were very, very violent and aggressive against the pagan gods. And there's a lot of theories. I don't know for sure, but there's some theories that the Christians were the ones that actually burned Rome. A famous fire. The Christians were the ones that started, because there'd be no reason for was it Nero to do this? Because what was burned were the temples. They burned the scrolls. They burned the temples. They burned the art. All the things that conveniently were offensive to the Christians. The pagans wouldn't have done that unless it was a pure mistake. The pagans would have had no reason to burn their own altars. That's obscene. So the Christians initially acted very similar to how the Jews acted, and that pissed the Romans off. And in fact, people might not think the Romans were very accepting of religion, because you learn about the Celts, and Caesar went after the Druids. But why did he go after the Druids? The same reason They hated the, they didn't like the Jews. Well, they were open to them, but they just kept relapsing into rebellion. It was because the Druids were doing what they were doing in secret, and the Romans did not like that. And that's how the Christians were originally meeting. They were meeting in secret. And if you're an empire and you're a Caesar, people are meeting in secret and they have a big following. Sounds like revolution. Not a good idea. It really had little to do with religion and a lot more to do with politics and the fear of having your government and your power overthrown, I think, is what a lot of it was. So to answer your question, I think that's the Christian and Jewish version. And the Muslim version is relatively similar to that. I know that it's long-winded, but these questions require a large amount of context and historical points, I think, to really provide a clear answer.
Yeah. Hey, Ryan, before I jump into my next question, I'm curious because you're in Tokyo, and I don't know if you've heard this yet, but did you know that Israel bombed Lebanon today?
No, I just assume they do that every day. So,
right. Okay.
I didn't know that though. No, I didn't.
Yeah, that happened while I was at work today. But I did want to ask you, do you know where costumes came in, and is that have to do with what we're talking about today?
Yes, it does. So there's a few levels or layers to this. So the Druids had three different colors of robes that they would wear. They would wear green, blue, and white. And some of the initiates would wear all three colors because they were being initiated into the order. Now, that's not where costumes came from, but there's a similar idea here because the different costumes, the different colors represented different things. For example, green represented nature. Blue represented truth and wisdom, knowledge, and white represented purity and innocence. This is like the arch druid, the head druids. And if you translate that to costumes, it's a similar idea. The costumes, they don't just represent, I mean, today you're like a nurse or you're a doctor, you're a cowboy, you're an astronaut, you know, you walk like an Egyptian, or maybe you dress up like a zombie or something. But the reason that people would dress up in costumes, it wasn't necessarily...
Humanity is drunk. What the fuck is going on? They poison in the mind so we can't see right from wrong. We can't define a woman, and now women have dongs. They strip away our rights, and these people cheer them on. This is modern warfare, a kind we've never seen. It's a war against man taking place upon a screen. It's a war to imprison you and take away your soul. Corrupt all men, but we say, fuck no! Had enough of the lies, had enough of deceit. Went to red. Same vibe, it wasn't just about shirts, it was a fight to survive. No more silence, hell no, no more playing it safe. If we don't speak up right now, then who's gonna speak in our place? They want a one world order, wanna spit in their face. Cause I'm not a little bitch and I'll never be the slave. So we speak in designs and we speak with our threads. Not afraid to speak our minds, took some pills, yeah they read. Had enough of the lies, had enough of deceit. Went to red pill threats to take this fight to the street. Crazy, but we weren't wrong. We stay standing ground when the sheep go along. Truth in every stitch, a message you can feel. Redpillthreads.com. Go grab it for a deal.
It had nothing to do really with occupation. It had to do with necessity. So what you were dressing up in were what was available, animal, you know, heads or animal skins or whatever. And the purpose, the primary purpose of doing that was to scare away the malevolent spirits. The other purpose was to, if you dress up nice, to welcome your ancestors or the people that have died, and to help them with light proceed through purgatory, proceed into the afterlife. It's the same exact reason your question could be altered for the question of why we leave food out. Same exact reason. You leave food out to appease the mischievous spirits. Hopefully they'll take the food as an offering, especially the fairies, and they'll go away. Or you leave food out as a feast, part of the Halloween feast, for your relatives. It's like leaving a door open for Elijah, glass of wine and a plate of food for Elijah in the Jewish tradition. You leave the door open essentially for your family to come in, and they have, you have a place set for grandma who passed away, and she has some food. And so these are the reasons we wear costumes. We have food. Now, there are some other reasons too. There are reasons, for example, when people have the Krampus walks. You ever heard of a Krampus walk or a Krampus festival for
Christmas? I have not. Oh, yeah, so for Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for Christmas.
It has to do with Krampus. Is that what you're saying? Like the yin and the yang, basically Santa Claus and Krampus, the good and the evil.
Well, yeah, in a sense, I wasn't saying that, but you're right. That's a little bit of the story for sure. I was using Krampus as an example because I think it's probably more popular than the Halloween. Well, maybe some of Halloween traditions are more popular. I don't know. I think Krampus is very popular, getting more popular today. And there's a lot of Krampus walks all over Europe and in the U.S., Krampus movies as well. And people were put on the Krampus masks. And I remember reading, I think it was 2 years ago, it was last year, 2 years ago, you know, religious people in the U.S. were very upset. Look at these people dressed like demons. They're evil. These are Satanists. And I read that and I thought, I just wish that people weren't so obsessed with these ideologies, because it's the, sure, there's probably some weird people in Portland. There's probably some weird people in, I lived in New York, Rochester. They had stuff like that. There's probably some weird liberal people there that do put on those masks like, yeah, this is demonic and Satanism. I love Satan. But that's not what it's meant for. It's meant to, like I just explained, it's meant to ward off evil. And it's also meant to blend in with the spirits. It's also meant to pay your respects to the spirits. It's the same thing when you look into Mexican tradition and you have the Day of the Dead. People put skulls on their face. They paint their face to look like a skeleton. You're not doing that because you worship death. That's absurd, especially in Mexico. It's a 90-something percent Catholic country. They don't worship death. They worship Mary. No, they do that because it is a memento mori. You will die. You will die. Everybody will die. Everything dies. But everything also is resurrected, which used to be a tenet of Christianity too, that you'll be reincarnated, which is a tenet, I think, of Druidism as well. So you have this skeletal face, or you have hang up skeletons, or you have scary masks, because you're reminded of that monster inside of you. You're reminded of the monsters in nature, the things that could get you. You're reminded of the primal self. And that translates from Halloween into Christmas, not just because of Krampus, but because the Romans had their Saturnalia. And at Saturnalia, they'd have a reversal of the roles, where people would become the opposite of what they normally are. So a slave, for example, might be given the hat of freedom, which is the Mithra cap, and they might be allowed to sit at the table for the night and have a big meal. And the person that owns that table might perform some of the chores that evening. To what extent these rituals were literally carried out, I don't know, but they called it the Lords of Misrule, where everything was turned upside down, because that's what happens in the winter. We turn, it's the upside down world. It's cold, it's very frightening, and it's flipped upside down. They called that the Lords of Misrule, and they would also wear, you know, costumes, or they dress in a different way. As if we were to do a Christmas show this year, for example, you'll find that a lot of the Christmas traditions around the world, where they're not focused strictly on botany, are focused primarily on a very similar, almost identical concept to what Halloween is based on. And that is primarily just the changing of the seasons and the roles that we play in the world and how we relate and connect to nature.
So, and I would absolutely love to do a Christmas episode with you. The one of the bigger parts of Halloween is trick or treat. Did this come from a Celtic or Druid practice, or is this something that we adopted later on during the commercialization of Halloween?
It's a little bit of both. There's different forms of trick or treating. So trick or treating, as we do it today, you've probably noticed, like a lot of people have, that trick-or-treating isn't done like it was even 10 years ago. Now there's a lot of like trunk or treat, right? So it's kind of transitioned even in the modern day. We've gone from going door to door on a certain night to some communities change the date because of people working, or we have trunk or treat because people are scared of, you know, apples having razors in them, which I maintain is still, I think that's, there's a conspiracy with the candy companies to promote that idea. I really do. Because apples were always the central feature of Halloween, and all of a sudden they got razors in them. You got to buy candy bars now. It's total nonsense, total bullshit. So anyway, that is like largely an urban legend, by the way. So I think that
it would make sense too, because all the apples here where I live, they're laying on everybody's lawn and they're not doing anything with them. So like right now would be the perfect time to give those out.
That's the whole point. Yep. Got an abundance of apples. Give them out. No, they got razors in them. Here, take this candy that's filled with lighter fluid and car engine, antifreeze and some of those candies. Anyway, so it's a good question, because if you look in the modern world, contemporary times, you can see a transition happening. And it makes me think, like, in 50 years, are we just only going to do trunk or treat? Is there going to be anybody going door to door? Now, if you go back a few hundred years, you go back to, say, the potato famine, you had a lot of Irish people coming here. That's where a lot of the traditions came from. If you go back before that into the history of Ireland, the history of Scotland, the history of Wales, the history of England, it's not that trick-or-treating exclusively comes from these places, because it is a universal idea. But you have to look at it from a different point of view, because trick-or-treating wasn't trick-or-treating then like it is now. Yes, people might, like in England, 300-400 years ago, they might go to a neighbor's house and they might ask for a drink, or they might ask for money, which is a common thing in England. But usually they would give some sort of pastry or something that they baked. They'd either give it or they would receive it. And the pastries are called soul cakes. It's a very old practice in Scotland and Ireland. And the soul cakes were basically what they sound like, soul cakes, the cakes that represent the soul of the dead. And you give and receive them and offer prayers for the people that have passed away. So actually, sometimes people would go give their neighbors the soul cakes. So the kids wouldn't get candy. They'd give their neighbors the soul cake and say, please pray for my grandma, my grandpa, my aunt, my uncle, etc. But if you go back further than that, we go back into the very old traditions. It's not that people were necessarily going door to door. It's that the spirits were going door to door, and the spirits were rattling your doors. The wind was blowing. So you'd leave out the food so that they wouldn't trick you. So you leave them the treat. And it's really, it's kind of a, you know, it's a contractual obligation. I've always been a big fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And there's a great episode where they're arguing about these trick-or-treaters, and the cop says, well, it's kind of like, because they vandalized this guy's house. And he says, the cop's like, well, it's a contract. You open the door, it's a trick-or-treat. You either give the treat or they trick you. And that is what the spirits were doing, right? They are either going to, they're mischievous. They're either going to not toilet paper your house in those days, but they're going to do the equivalent of that 300,000-500,000 years ago. And you either give them the treat or you get tricked. At least that's the belief, that's the idea, that's kind of where it comes from. And they actually called that going a scowling. And I think it was largely in England, they called it going a scowling. So like a scowl on your face. Because you go around, you might not have a mask, you go around really angry and doing the trick-or-treating. Then they also have the opposite of that, which is called going a Maine. So May is like the counterpart. May, April is the counterpart of Halloween on the wheel of the year. So they had going a Maine, which would be the opposite, had a lot more to do with flowers and pastries and things like that. But yes, to answer your question, that's largely where it comes from.
I will say that living in this time is awesome because you and I get to have this conversation on totally different ends of the world right now. And we get to share this knowledge with so many different people. And it is awesome. However, man, things just seem so much more beautiful and meaningful, like in further times back. I would rather even live in the 50s. You know, it just seems so much more wholesome. And we take these ideas like Halloween and we take almost a beautiful thing and then we turn it into an excuse for girls to dress up like prostitutes and people to get drunk and get kids binged out on candy. And everybody forgets why we're doing this to begin with. Like, where did these things come from? And I'm so happy that we have somebody like you out there that takes the time, because we ask these questions, but nobody actually digs into these things to figure out the answer. And it's fucking awesome that you do this. And your show is amazing. And I hope that everybody listening to this, or if you're watching live, thank you, by the way. If you are, go ahead and scroll down right now, because I have his links right there. And give him a follow, because you will never be disappointed when you tune into one of his shows. But
you might be angry, but not
enough. Well, there is a lot to be angry about, bro. And you don't always come off as angry. You come off as getting the information across. I mean, I listen to people that I think sound angry as fuck, all like Crow 777. I know he's not angry, but he sounds angry. I still listen to him. But you have you have the voice that was made for radio. So it's also like a double plus, you know. I don't know who has a better voice, you or Doc Brown. Have you talked to him ever?
I've never talked to him, though. No, I have not.
He is awesome. He wrote the book called Epic of Esau, and he points out that Esau in the Bible is our first representation of Bigfoot that we have documented.
Oh, interesting. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, it's a great theory. I think you guys would have a very good conversation if you ever want to talk to him. I could definitely make that happen for you. Go ahead, brother.
I'm sorry. Well, one really quick thing, then go back to your question. But just because you gave that example from that book, something kind of interesting. I interviewed D.M. Murdoch, or Acharya S. She was a scholar, and she wrote a lot about the similarities of religions and the astrological components of them, like astrotheology. And I had her on one time, and she had said that I don't know how tongue in cheek it was, but you know how I said the apple having the razors kind of like maybe candy company propaganda. She thought that maybe some of what was in the Bible, where it was kind of institutionalized, might, like the references to wine. She said she thought that a lot of that might have actually been propaganda from the wine manufacturers to stick that into the book to get people to buy more wine. I don't know if that's true. Probably not. I just thought it was an interesting observation from a respected scholar.
Yeah, that is very interesting, because there's a lot of people that will describe the wine back then as nothing like the wine that we have today, where they added a lot of different stuff. And it was like, it was very meaningful to them. And the wine that they gave sometimes would have like hallucinogens in it and stuff like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if it is another propaganda thing. You know, I know that there's some very shady people involved at the Council of Nicaea, and the book that we get today is what they wanted us to see, you know. And I would love to get my eyes in the Vatican and their locked library that they have that nobody gets to see. That would just, if like anybody granted me a wish, it is give me a week in there. Give me at least a week in there.
I think a lot of people probably feel that way. I didn't mention this. I think it should be noted very quickly, and then please ask that question you were going to ask, that one of the reasons that Rome was intolerant to Christians was because you have to understand, just generally speaking, not you, but you have to understand that you have this, what was an empire at the time, that is, everybody practices some version of this same polytheistic, quote, pagan, not the right word as we discussed, but pagan system. And I think it was Augustus who went to the Jews and said, look, here's the deal. You can practice whatever you want, but you have to assimilate to society, which means that I don't care what you worship. He said, I will, this is actually referenced in Gibbons. He said, I will offer up sacrifice to Yahweh. All I ask of you is to just throw some incense on the fire to Jupiter, and then we'll call it a deal. And the Jews spit in his face. And you can imagine why, you know, an imperator would be like, all right, fuck these people. And the Christians did something very similar. And it needs to be, I think, said and understood that you're not just spitting in the face of the emperor. You're not just spitting in the face of the Roman people, Jews or Christians. You're spitting in the face of their ancestors, their identity, the entire culture, and all the cultures that they represented. You're spitting in the face of all, at to that point, of human history, of civilization, of art, of music, of science, of everything. You're basically rejecting it all and mocking it and stepping all over it. And you could see why that would really piss people off if someone just randomly came out of the woods and said, hey, by the way, all those parents and all those relatives and friends and your husband or wife that died, and you have these little tiny statuettes, which were very popular in Rome. You see that actually in the Gladiator movies. He has his wife and child. Yeah, all of those are evil, and we're going to fucking burn them. And we're going to rip up all the images that represent your family and all the images that represent your relatives. And we're going to burn the temples down that have kept society together for thousands of years. And then you expect not to have your head cut off? Like, you have to put this in context, whether you're Jewish or Christian. It's a lot easier, of course, for people to just be like, ah, the Romans were like Nazis. They're just a bunch of white supremacists. Rome was not white. The Italians weren't white. And most of the empire stretched from West Asia into Africa. They had blacks, Asians, etc., and everything in between. So that narrative is just so false. And it's not that I agree or disagree with any particular belief. It's just a matter of there's a reason why the Romans had an issue with the Jews. And there's a reason why they had an issue with the Christians. And there's a reason why they had an issue with the Druids. They were doing stuff in secret. Maybe they're plotting to overthrow the government. I don't know. There's a reason. There's always a reason. I think that just needs to be said. Doesn't mean that you agree with it, but there's a reason why. And that's an important part of history, the reason, the context, why.
What the shizer is up, my fellow conspiracy junkies? Seriously, though, have you guys checked out charismictruestore.com yet? If you haven't, stop what you're doing right now and go check it out, because I am telling you guys right now, if you're looking for truther gear, this is the place that you want to be. I like the store so much that I made this little jingle for it. So, hey, yo, DJ Don't Exist, play that track I like. Biatch! Let's go!
CharismaTruthStore.com, speaker of the truth, so calm. Promo code KJOKE10 gets your gear again and again and again. Gear again and again. Gets your gear again and again. Gets your gear again and again.
Charismic. Man, I have like 100 questions for you, but we are getting here like 15 minutes left in the episode, and I want to make sure that we were able to cover everything about Halloween. Maybe if there was anything that you left out that we haven't, we can jump on that right now.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about this for hours and hours and hours. I've already done 3 shows this week on the subject, but one of the more overlooked aspects of Halloween, and one of the things that we definitely haven't talked about tonight, is that we think of costumes and candy, but one of the most important things to understand about Halloween is that it's a holiday or holy day, and it's a 3-day festival, which was turned by the church into All Saints Day and All Souls Day. What it is it's a time for spirit communion and divination. That line is blurred. Your ancestors, the spirits, people that died this year, everybody's right there. And if you have maybe a husband or a wife or a child who died, It's a perfect time when the veil is thin to commune with them. And so communion with the dead or divination was a very important part of Halloween. Now, I know people think divination, oh, tarot cards and hippie crystal witch women. And no, that's not what divination was. It wasn't some woman charging $50 for a tarot reading to be like, oh yeah, the death card, that means you're going to die. It's a little bit more complex, but yet simple. It was throwing nuts into a fire. It was having bread baked and baking into the bread a key or a ring. And whoever finds the key or the ring gets something in return. And what they got in return and why they would throw nuts in a fire, or why they would pick up cabbages, or in Scotland, they'd pull kale or leeks from the ground. It all had to do with marriage. It all had to do with love, or it had to do with prosperity. So if you were already married and you got the ring or you got the key and the bread, then you were going to have a prosperous year. And you could ask questions like, all right, am I going to be successful in this business venture, for example? But most of it was about marriage. Apple bobbing, or some version of apple bobbing, was another important part. Apples, nuts, cabbage, potatoes, kale and leeks are big, big, big foodstuffs. We're talking about Halloween. That's a traditional Halloween meal, by the way. So if you're thinking in any way, shape, or form that there's anything evil about it, I think it's funny, because I would assume that most Christians and a lot of conservative people very much value marriage. We hear that a lot still.
And they throw bouquets, which is, they throw a bouquet and yeah, they shoot the garter. It's basically the same thing. And you're, I know, right, I know the nut story. And I think that's very interesting too, is you would throw two nuts, right? And that's into, right, a fire. And if one of them like jumped out or charred or something like that, it was not the right person, right? You would think of two potential suitors, and then each nut represents that suitor, and it would tell you which one is best for you.
That's right. And there were other versions where they used rocks. They'd carve something in the rock, throw two rocks in a fire, let it burn overnight, see where the rocks are at the next day. But it was all primarily, and men did it too, it wasn't just women, but it was primarily based on marriage. So when the Druids lost power and were overcome by the Romans, and then later the Christians, and the Christianity took over, and the snakes were driven out of Ireland, what happened was, it's kind of ironic, the Christians just said, okay, your cross is now replaced by our cross, and your sacred wood is now replaced by our wooden church, and your sacred cross is now replaced by our sacred cross, our wooden cross, the same exact cross. And your savior is replaced by our savior, and your omnipotent God is replaced by our omnipotent God, and your everlasting life is replaced by our everlasting life. Oh, and by the way, the Druids also had a Madonna and child, like Isis and Horus, Mary and Jesus. And the Christians said, oh, by the way, your Madonna and child is evil and ours is good. And they just replaced most of it. Didn't have to replace it. They just, you ever use like a Word document, or if you're online and you want to make sure you spelled a word correctly and you copy and paste it from a dictionary and you copy it and paste it and it doesn't change because you spelled it right? That's pretty much what the Christians did in the Celtic lands. They're just like, all right, so that cross is evil. Let's replace it with this one. It's the same cross. And it's the same story. They had Madonna and child. They had all the same ideas, and they were just replaced by Christian ones. It's kind of weird. It's kind of funny. But divination is the one thing that is probably most central, especially because it's a great way to deal with the nerves of what's going to happen with the winter time and if you're going to survive. Because that's usually what happened. If you didn't get married, you died. That's pretty much the idea. You look at what's in the, you know, what's in the bread. You don't get a ring. You don't get a key. You're not getting married. You're probably going to die next year. It was hope and prosperity and love or death. And so if people are really, really conservative Christian, people are really, really promoting the idea of marriage, then you have to promote Halloween divination because it's based on the same idea. It wasn't like, you know, rolling dice, like I need some money. I need a new pair of shoes and then roll the dice. It was, I want to get married. And that's not a bad or evil thing. Maybe for some people it is, but it's not a bad thing overall.
Yeah, I would say that today it could be a bad thing, but yeah, it was essential back in the day. And Man, this has been freaking awesome. I had a question and it escaped me, and because I was so tuned into what you were saying, I totally forgot what I was going to ask you. That happens to me at least once every episode. But I did want to rewind back, and I want to know if you have you read or even know of the book called Pillars of Wisdom? And it's a new book. I had the guy on my show.
No, I don't. I haven't really read any new books for a very long time, so I don't know it.
This guy came on, and I'm Christian, and I'm not offended by anything that you said today. And he came on, and I was a little bit offended when he said this at first. And now I have the book, and I can see it as a possibility. But this guy claims that Jesus did the lion's head ritual, which is a ritual that involves killing a lion and then burying its head in the street. And during this ritual, if it's completed correctly, you will have followers for eternity. And what? I don't know what basis he has to back this up, but you did mention that Jesus went to different places across the world that's not mentioned in the Bible, and that he was practicing magic. And I find it very hard to believe that he didn't go to some sort of secret teaching schools with as much knowledge that he had.
Without doubt, he just exposed it publicly.
Yeah, 100%. Ryan, you are awesome. Thank you very much for coming on the show. I know it's rough. We had a schedule mishap yesterday, but we were able to make it happen today, and I greatly appreciate you taking time out of your day. And if there's anything that you would like to leave my listeners with, the floor is yours.
Yes, two things. I'll mention my website and book, but the first thing is the idea of the lion. Not only is that a symbol of the sun, at least in the West, in the East not as much. The tiger is more revered in the East, but the idea of the lion, if you look at the Mithric cult and Mithraism, you have very much the same things that you have in Zoroastrianism and you have in the Druidic cult. But in Mithraism, when you are resurrected symbolically, it's a symbolic resurrection. When you're resurrected symbolically, you were called the lion. And in Egypt, when you were resurrected out of the sarcophagus, the tomb, it brought you back to life after 3 days of usually suspended animation because you had been dosed with some sort of substance, blue water lily in Egypt. Ayahuasca in the Americas, or peyote or poppy or soma or whatever it was, they would grip your hand, the priest would grip your hand, and they would call this the grip of the lion. So you were resurrected as a lion, both in Egypt and in the Mithric cult, and Jesus was the Lion of Judah, and the lion is the sun, and we have a very similar motif here again, and it's more than just those examples I gave you, but it's another great example of what the Christians believe is true. It's just not necessarily literally true. And that's the main difference. And then, you know, the stuff about the jihad and people interpreting that as literal, that's also not literal for the Muslims. It's supposed to be an internal battle between good and evil, like in Zoroastrianism. So keep that in mind, and keep in mind the idea that the apocalypse and Armageddon, that people might bring the real eschaton about, like a literal interpretation of it. I think that's what Israel was created for as a country, but it's more a metaphor for the changing of the seasons and the cycles of nature. And that's not a scary thing at all. At least it shouldn't be a scary thing. And I should also mention as part of that, that the idea of Israel is a term that represents all of mankind, because everybody is chosen by God. Everybody is God's chosen people, which relates back to that lion paw in Egypt. Because when you were resurrected after 3 days and the lion paw grabbed you and said, for example, insert name blank, rise or come forth. By the way, the same exact terms that Jesus used to raise Lazarus from the dead. The Egyptians used them to raise people from the dead symbolically. Lazarus, come forth. Whoever the initiate was, come forth. You would exit the temple to the rising sun. And when you exited the temple to the rising sun, you would be classified as a child, no longer of man, no longer of woman, but a child of God. You'd become a son or a daughter of God. And that's in the Egyptian tradition, if you're, I think it was more so, they had masons. Masons were, I think they still call some masons the children of, I can't remember the exact name. It's like the children of the widow Isis. So you're the children of the goddess, which means you're the children of God, the children of creation, the children of the earth. It's the same exact idea because Isis is the widow. So anyway, all of that's, I think, very positive. And that's really the core of, if I have a message, that's kind of the message. If you want to find my books, like Occult Arcana, it's a huge book. I'd be happy to send you a digital copy of it. I published them myself, so I can't really send a physical one. But if you want a digital one, I'd be happy to send you one for doing the interview today. If anybody wants to buy one, you can find it on my website, tstradio.info, or thesecretteachings.info, same website. Social media links are on the website, and that's pretty much it. It's just go to the website. It's all right there. You can find the show Monday through Friday, and it's brand new every day, Monday through Friday, consistently every day, 5 nights a week, independent. And we also do, because listeners support us and subscribe to the ad-free show, we also do a Friday evening live video stream, which you can find on our social media as well. So tstradio.info. And if anybody wants to email me, rdgable, rdgable@yahoo.com. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely, Ryan. You came and you crushed it. And honestly, this is one of the first times I didn't have to do most of the talking. That was fucking awesome. And
Oh, really?
if you, yeah, yeah. If you guys liked what you heard today, this is just like scratching the surface of him getting into Halloween and what he's got out already this week. So I have those linked. If you guys are watching right now, if you want to scroll down, his link should be right there. You can click on that and give him a follow, and you will not be disappointed. And
Yeah, the book also, Occult Arcana, my big book, also has a, I mean, it's a huge book. It's like 630 pages of like, it's like a paper from like a printer. Huge book. It's a massive book. And there's a giant section in the book on holidays, like where the holidays came from. And there's a subsection there about Halloween. So it's a huge book, but there's a giant section on Halloween and Christmas in there. Goes through a lot, not all, but most of the stuff we talked about tonight.
that's awesome, brother. I can't wait to get into it. It's probably going to take me a while to get through it, but I would definitely appreciate it if you sent that to me and I will read it. And hopefully, some people listening along will buy that book and get some of the knowledge that you have. And brother, and hopefully we can click again in December as well and do a Christmas episode. That would be awesome. I also
Sure
like
thing.
to let you know, I know that you do your Friday night things, but every Friday, I just started doing roundtable lives every Friday evening at 7. And you never know who's going to come in here. I try to get a couple big names mixed with some people that you've never heard of before. And you have an open seat anytime you would like to join us, brother.
Cool. It sounds fun. I think that's right when my Friday show ends. So good timing
Awesome.
sometime.
Awesome. Well, hopefully we'll see you in on one of those. And until December, everybody, go check his stuff out on his own page, and we're going to end this the way that we always do, and that is keep digging down those rabbit holes.
Matrix catalyst on the mic exposing fake and gay shit. Conspiracy junkies, we don't fuck with no sheep. Awaken the lions, let the weak stay asleep. Follow the rabbit down the hole we go. Are we stuck in the matrix shit? I don't know. Secret revealed, all lies exposed. Catalyst Jones will never be controlled. Flat earth whispers cut the mainstream's haze. MK Ultra's grip, minds locked in a maze. Hollywood's in the frame, peel back the lies, it's a rigged fucking game. Eyes on the shadow, see the system's design. Whispers in the dark where the secrets align. Rip through the code, I'm done with the plan. Unplug my soul, I'm a free fucking man. Zionist circles plot powers hid in the vault. Truth buried deep, but I'm calling their fault. Call me anti-Semitic, go ahead, fuck it, that's fine. Got no feelings for your feelings, truth's my only lie. Revealed, all lies exposed. Catalyst.
Truth is my weapon and my story's told.